to the after party. It's time to change. You're just getting started. You can teach an old dog new ways, and not just on Saturdays.
Hey, this is Anna David. You are listening to After Party Podcast, all about addiction and recovery. I host another podcast that is called You've Got Issues with Anna David. You can find that wherever podcasts are not sold because they're free. I just sounded like the guy from that commercial about mattresses, which is a funny thing since my guest today is a voiceover artist. But here's what I'm going to say. I'm going to get right into the guest because I'm tired of hearing myself talk. If you want to hear more of me talk, go listen to my other podcast because that's where I'm getting it all out. I will just tell you this one fact, which is that After Party Pod is a part of After Party Magazine, which is a part of RehabReviews.com, the world's largest resource for rehab reviews. If you're looking for treatment, if your loved one is looking for treatment, that's where you go. You can also email me, Anna@theafterpartygroup.com. I promised I'd get right into the guests. I'm going to get right into the guests. Maurice LaMarche, which is a terribly fun name to say, is a wonderful guy I have known during my entire sobriety. He's someone I used to see all the time. See him less now, but I read somewhere something that he said out there in the world about recovery, and I said, I didn't know Maurice was open about this, and so I messaged him, and I was able to get him on this show. You have heard his voice so much, it's amazing you're not exhausted by the number of times you've heard his voice. Where do I start? Truly, where do I start? Well, I could start by telling you that he is best known for voicing the Brain in Animaniacs. His numerous characters that he voiced in Futurama, he won an Emmy for. So, and then there's everything in between. Transformers, The Simpsons, Batman, Kung Fu Panda, The Powerpuff Girls, Rick and Morty, Girl Meets World. Okay, I hadn't heard of that one. The Legend of Korra. There are so many, and many commercials, and many other things, and he's a brilliant impressionist. You get into hear all about that in his interview, which I'm going to give you now.
I first started taking drugs by chewing blocks of hash.
Oh my God, I think my copy has like blood stains on it from shooting up while reading it.
Party animal, I hate to say that because that makes me sound Paris Hilton-y. I was on the, as I call it, the Autobahn to Nowhere.
I'm very lucky because would you have wanted to have a celebrity junkie for a dad?
So yeah, we're going. It's so nice of you to come in and do this.
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, well, we've known each other, I was trying to remember, probably about 16 years.
At least. Yeah.
And
we have many mutual friends.
We have many mutual friends. Yes. Now, this is, I'm just springing a super weird thing at the beginning. I remember one time you telling me you had a really weird dream and I was in it.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
I remember that, that we stopped. Were you in it or? I guess
how
you
would
were.
I know, Maurice?
I think, no, wait. I'm saying you're really, I know I mentioned it to you. So I think you were in it.
Yeah, why would you have just randomly told me about a weird dream?
Yeah, you're right. You were in it. But it wasn't like a dirty dream.
No, of course it wasn't, or you wouldn't have said anything. But I ran into you early in the morning, and I think you would had it that morning, and you said to me,
you got right up.
This is so weird.
I wish I could remember the dream.
I don't think you could even remember it at the time. I think it was one of those, well, you were you, but you were someone else. And we were in a tunnel.
I think it's one of those things where the dream is so fresh, and a lot of dreams occur, and you sort of observe them from a distance, as it were.
Yes.
And then there are those dreams where you can actually like smell the cookies baking.
Yes.
And you're so present, you're so there in the dream. I had a dream like that about my father the other, it was an afternoon dream, actually. I took a quick little nap. I'm a big nap. And my dad was like it was a mundane dream where he just was talking to me and giving me a bit of fatherly advice. But I mean, it's like I could smell his cologne. He was as tangible as could be. And then I woke up and I actually had myself just a little bit of a misty-eyed moment afterwards. He's been gone since 1987. You know, so it's almost 30 years. That's the way it is with loss.
Sometimes in the subconscious.
Reach for them in your dreams. That's where they come visit you.
Yeah, I almost had a misty-eyed moment with you just talking about it.
Oh, well.
It's very sweet. This is a weird thing that I've been asked and I can't answer. Do you dream in color? And do you see yourself or is it through your POV?
I know that I dream in color because there are colors I refer to in the dreams, and plus black and white pisses me off. So,
you mean you say what a beautiful Orange sunset?
Sunset, or, you know, they look at this red towel I'm using to wash my hands or whatever. And I'm a POV dreamer. I don't think I ever see myself in the dream. I see everybody else.
Yeah.
I definitely, everything happens on at the end of my fingers.
I kind of imagine most of us are that.
Which is what that bugs me when I see a movie where they're showing a dream sequence and the guy's in the dream. And I'm going, the guy's not supposed to be there.
Oh, good point.
It's happening to the guy. He can't be in the dream. That's why we know it's not really a dream.
Well, okay, because a lot of times the dream sequence is you then find out that it wasn't a dream or something like that,
yes.
And they couldn't pull one over on
That's
you.
That's right,
you didn't.
Exactly.
This was a segue before we even got started.
You almost want it to be like Columbo comes out from behind a pillar and goes, "Excuse me, ma'am, I'm sorry to bother you, but that's not how dreams work."
Well, for anyone who's not already familiar with this, you just revealed that you are...
My superpower.
Yes. I didn't know you could do... I mean, of course you can do imitations.
I started out in stand-up comedy, doing impressions. I had an all-impressions act. In fact, the thing that I kind of was working on when I stopped was putting a little bit more point of view, a little bit more of me in the act, because I pretty much just came on, set up wacky situation for a celebrity that they shouldn't be in kind of thing, and then went. Peter Falk and Johnny Carson as waiters. Strange episode of Fantasy Island with me playing all the parts. Go. And I finally went, yeah, I want to say something from the stage. I don't want to just be this guy who puts on little skits. But a natural offshoot of that, of course, was to take it into voiceover work, which is where I butter my bread now. The interesting part of stand-up comedy thing is, just as I was getting good, was when the disease, alcoholism, took hold. I often say I don't have any opinion on whether or not you're born with the illness or whether it develops based on circumstances, whether it's predilection or whether anybody could be turned into an alcoholic by enough tragedy, enough alcohol, enough self-obsession, and enough fear. But for me, I definitely crossed the line when my father was murdered. That's why we both got a little misty-eyed. I know you know my story.
I honestly had forgotten
that part of the story. And his murder was sort of a huge shock to the system, presented me with an existential dilemma. Is there goodness in the world? Would a good God allow this? A nice guy like my father being killed by the psychopath who killed him. The psychopath apparently had a jailhouse conversion. Well, what does that mean? My dad's in hell while the psychopath's going to heaven. And it just spun me out. And my answer to that was to just numb off as much as I could.
How old were you with that?
I was 27.
And, well, what was your experience with drinking up until that point?
I was pretty much a normal drinker.
Well, but a normal drinker up to the age of 27 is a pretty hard heavy drinker, wouldn't you say?
Well, I would say I probably went drinking a couple nights a week with my friends, but I was always like the designated driver. I didn't go over that line until I began to literally slam alcohol and a couple of other substances into me to just numb that pain and that fear and just that the scream, that painting the scream, that moment that would come up for me every day. And then the drinks began to take the drink. It no longer became about killing the pain of dad. It just became about, I don't know how to live without the drink and without the substances.
Were you conscious of the fact that you were trying to drown out the scream?
Certainly.
You knew.
Initially,
you didn't think
you were
having
fun. In fact, I even said when a couple of friends and my wife made mention, although we were just living together at the time, my mantra was, you don't know what it's like to have your father murdered. I need to kill this pain. Somewhere in there was a strawberry that gave me the allergy, you know. The cucumber became the pickle. And it just became about, I don't know how not to drink today.
How long did that take, that transition?
I was a real flash in the pan kind of story. I mean, I wish I had this long, dramatic story.
60 days?
No, 3.5 years. I would say from the real getting really bad, noticeably bad, like crossing that line, to the day I got sober, which was January 20th, 1989. So as we inaugurate our new president, I'll celebrate 28 years. And every time we've inaugurated a president, it's been a multiple of 4 for me because it's been an unbroken sobriety. I just don't drink one day at a time, as I know most of your guests have talked about. And I shouldn't, you know, I got to tell you, there were a couple of other runs at getting sober, but it was treatment, it was hospital programs and things like that. And, you know, I never quite got, I can't take the first drink. That was all that fancy stuff, you know, the $13,000 big book. I just never got, hey, it's the first drink that gets you drunk.
How many times did you go to treatment?
I went to one treatment and made a couple of other like inpatient things.
And you really wanted?
One residential treatment. I wanted, and yet I still wanted to be able to get away with a glass of wine with dinner. What do you mean no glass of wine with dinner? I understand the other stuff, but you're telling me I just can't have some red wine with my, can't have some Chianti with my fava beans? I just wanted to be able to manage and control. Control and enjoy, which they often say, one or the other. You can control but not enjoy. Some alcoholics can. And you can enjoy, but you won't be controlling. And I didn't get it until January 20th, 1989. I don't know what half a sober person said to me. It's the when a train kills you. When you get hit by a train, it's not the engine that kills you. It's not the caboose that kills you. It's the engine, right? And I said, yeah. So I just don't take the first drink.
So you literally remember the moment it flipped for you.
You mean in sobriety?
Yes, you remember this person saying
this. I remember that guy
thing.
And I remember his friend saying, and all you got to do is stay sober till your head hits the pillow tonight. And I had always heard the one day at a time trope and thought, well, at 12:01 a.m., it's a new day. And if I still feel like crap, I'm going to Hughes Market and getting a bottle. And that's what I would do. And wait, oh, you mean head hits the pillow? All right, I'll wait till my head hits the pillow. And then after I got that day, I don't know why, because I'd gotten a bunch of other one day at a times, but that day felt more like a miracle than any other of the days of sobriety that I'd had, where I just felt like I was kind of white knuckling it. I'd really made the surrender to the idea that this was an illness, I have it, and I can only do it with outside help, with help from others, with help from a power greater than myself, and just don't take the first drink.
So how did you get to the idea of a power greater than yourself that would allow the tragedy to happen?
Well, I kind of skimmed through a book called When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And although I've often said it's harder for me to understand when good things happen to bad people, which is a cute little joke. But in that book, that's a rabbi named Harold Kushner. He talks about a God who doesn't control everything. A God who doesn't even necessarily allow everything. He simply watches and gives strength when called on. And I thought to myself, I can wrap my mind around that, because there are so many, I mean, leaving my dad out of it, there's so many even more senseless things that happen to the world that I have difficulty believing that A, God protects anybody, because that means he likes some of his kids better than other kids, or that he allows things because he's got a better plan. We were very close to, when I say we, I mean my entire family, my wife and myself, but especially my son, who's 22 years old and an awesomely talented guitar player. And he went on tour with the singer Christina Grimmie. It's 2 years ago. And they were the best of friends, like as close as friends as you can be, a guy and a girl, and still be buddies. I mean, she was at my house 2-3 times a week. And as we know the story goes, she was murdered by a fan at a meet and greet the night before the Pulse Club murders, but just down the street from it in Orlando, Florida. And my son is totally devastated by this, as are we all. But I don't have a belief that God allowed Christina. I think Christina was killed by a sick bastard who then blew his own brains out after killing her. Where God is in that is how we reach out to him and say, help me through this day. And I know her parents are very, very spiritual and very Christian, and they've shown a strength that to me was not possible when I was suffering through the loss of my dad. And you know, I know that they believe that there's a plan operating, and that's fine. That's for them. That's absolutely for them, and it helps them. I had just have to believe that God watched it and cried more than any of us did, and is there to give us strength. That's the spiritual approach I take.
Right. And then the world is just sort of haphazard and random.
I believe, unfortunately, that things just happen. They don't necessarily happen for a reason. They just happen. And it's up to us to do good, to help one another. And that's one of the great things that happens in a lot of the programs, well, especially the big one, which I will not say whether or not I'm a member of, because it's the nature of it to be anonymous, but I have a lot of friends who are in it, and they've told me. How do you like that for a little out?
Brilliant.
The most certain relief is promised in stopping thinking about yourself, stopping going after whatever it is you're chasing, whether it's relief from pain or just even trying to be sober by holding off on taking the drink and opening up the book or whatever it is, and go help somebody. Helping somebody else is the greatest relief from any ill. And I think that's what the higher power of my understanding wants from me. Just be helpful.
Okay, interesting. And what do you think that played a part in your obsession being removed?
On a daily basis. I mean, the obsession can come back. All I have to do is stop doing the work, the simple kit of spiritual tools. If I let up on that, it may not come the next day or the day after that or the day after that. But if I'm not helping others and really paying attention to my own spiritual fitness and being involved in some prayer and meditation, I can start obsessing on myself. I can start obsessing on the idea that maybe a glass of wine would be nice with dinner.
Has that happened in the 28 years?
There have been some times where I've been a bit lax. Luckily, I've noticed the thinking creep up, because I had alcoholic thinking long before I had alcoholic drinking. As a little kid, I remember being a little more self-obsessed obsessed even than the other kids.
How did you know?
I just did.
Not at the time.
I'll tell you why. I'll tell you. When I was a little guy, there used to be this TV show. You won't remember it because you're far too young, or as I'm ancient. There was a show called Wendy and Me, starring George Burns.
Thank God I don't remember. I was really worried I was going to remember.
Yeah, no, you won't remember.
Like, I'm much older than you.
And it was. I remember I was about 5 years old. George Burns would turn to the camera and break the fourth wall. So whenever something wacky happened with Wendy and her husband in the building, George Burns would turn to the camera and go, "Can you believe this?" And, you know, and I loved that. I loved the breaking of the fourth wall. And I'd be 5 years old and I'd walk around and the teacher we're talking to, and I'd turn to an imaginary camera and go, "Can you believe this?" at 4 years old, you know, 5 years old rather. And I remembered thinking like the whole world was this television show about me, that, and I always acted like that, even as a little kid, that somehow the TV cameras were following me and that I acted as though I was in a TV show.
I had the exact same thing. And not only that, I was just talking to a friend about that, and she too is now sober.
Oh,
so there may
amazing?
Be something to this.
Maybe the TV camera's God. Maybe we were talking to God the whole time.
Or maybe our lives are the Truman Show and we still haven't figured it out.
Right.
Just us and my friend.
We've all got our own Truman Show, and somebody somewhere in the celestial heavens is following. We're all a channel. We all have our own Us-Tube channel.
So yeah, we were just early to catch on to that,
I think, you and my friend.
I think
so.
But no, that's so interesting, because I would say, okay, sure, you can call that alcoholism if you want, but we were absorbed by pop culture. And
certainly.
I remember it was One Day at a Time when that show came on.
Oh, yes.
And I thought about the credits, and I distinctly remember the credits in the opening,
uh-huh.
whatever you call that. And I remember my mom was like, we were at the house, and my mom was like meeting with this like decorator. And I just remember like walking up this driveway thinking that like I was the opening credits for my television show. So
I never pictured credits. That's interesting.
No, you know how they used to do credits?
No,
in the beginning?
I like that.
Yeah,
I
it's good, right?
Because
you needed to have like a picturesque shot without dialogue.
Of course.
You know? So this in no way, yeah, like I said, it may actually support your theory that was alcoholic thinking.
I followed, of course, by, I was always the sensitive kid. I was always the one, my father used to say, I can always find you, the one crying in the friggin' schoolyard.
Aww.
Everything hurt my feelings.
Yeah.
And I didn't grow out of that. I had that little level of sensitivity all through my young adult life. And
yet you go into comedy. It is ironic.
And yet I go into comedy. Well, it's because I can't sing or dance.
But how many, you know, comedians are alcoholics and many of them sober now, and how many people who are arguably the people who should be the last to go out seeking public validation or rejection are the ones doing it?
I think it's the adrenal rush. I also had that weird experience of the first time I did it exceptionally well. I think if I'd have died on stage, I wouldn't have gone for it, but it went really, really well. So I got that endorphin rush. Mm-hmm. I got almost a standing ovation. I had a lot of those impressions in my act, and people love impressions. It's like the closest thing to magic without actually having props there and rabbits and things like that. Changing your voice, becoming somebody else. So I got big applause just for doing good impressions. It wasn't necessarily all that hilarious, but I was hooked. It's another addiction. I want that feeling again. I want to feel the rush of the people's laughter coming over me. I want to see them get on their feet again. And so, you know, anyway, I had a crowd-pleasing act. I never took a lot of chances because I wanted to make sure my drug, other people's approval and laughter, would still come towards me. Whereas my old pal Jim Carrey threw away the impressions circa 1985 and started doing this weird tightrope thing at the Comedy Store where sometimes he would do his entire set without getting a laugh, but he refused to do impressions and just talk to the audience. And from that grew who Jim became. He had the guts to do that, that I wouldn't take that chance. Yeah. And I've always liked that safe feeling, apart from going out in front of people. It's like, I'll go that far, but I won't go all the way. And maybe that's why I had such a short drinking and using. I'll go far enough to that I endanger my life, but I won't like flatline three times before I get sober. So as soon as I started feeling the first nip of the ringer, because the first nip for me was that my then girlfriend, now wife, I had an intervention and I'm actually the one who suggested it. She had this like list of like maybe 12 friends of mine, the 12 people who would still talk to me.
That's
and
a
I
lot
saw
of
the,
people. But yeah, you only had 3 years to really
right.
get
so,
them tired of you.
But she had this list on the kitchen table and she had moved out. She'd gone to stay with a friend and she had moved out, but there was this list. And when she came back to get some of her stuff, I know what this is. This is an intervention. You're going to have an intervention for me, aren't you? Well, I got news for you. I've seen Clean and Sober, okay? I know know what an interview, and that's not going to work with me. And turns out she wasn't going to have an interview. No, this was a list of people she was going to call if she came home one day and found my body. You know, these were the people she wanted to call and say, passed away. Because I was doing that level of drugs. Like I said, I didn't flatline the required three times as most people have in their stories.
But you know,
I pulled back. Pulled back from the precipice just in time. But she had this intervention for me that I suggested.
So you said, well, instead of calling them when I'm dead, why not call them now?
I didn't say anything. She just went, it's like, bing, a little light bulb. I know, I'll have an intervention.
She said it to you?
No.
No,
she secretly did it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I came home one day from...
And they were all 12 were there?
They were there.
Yeah.
They were there. And, you know, and I threw them all out.
Did you?
I did.
So like the TV show, like that level of anger
and... Yeah, and I just said, get out. And then all of a sudden, the one guy I didn't know, the guy who the intervention leader, I said, you can stay. All right, you can talk to me, but I don't want to hear from them. And he's the guy that convinced me to go into treatment. A guy named Lou Sandman. Lou Sandman. He was the Sandman, man. But Lou was the liaison between treatment programs and the SAG and AFTRA health plans.
He must have been a busy guy.
Yeah, he was, especially back in 1988.
And so are those 12 people still your friends?
Yes.
All of them.
Yeah, we don't see each other as often because a couple of them become very, very busy. Big people, you know.
Jim Carrey, et cetera. No, I'm not saying Jim was there.
Jim was not there. Jim and I, we were friendly. And in fact, like the first time Jim came out here, we hung out for 3 days. I used to say Jim Carrey stayed on my couch. I offered him my couch, but he wanted to be in a hotel. But I picked him up at the hotel at like 8:30 in the morning. We went pancakes. He hung out at my place all day long. And then I took him back to the hotel late at night after the Comedy Store. But Jim and I used to hang out and we're still very friendly with each other whenever we see each other. But no, I mean, Howie Mandel was a dear friend and he was there. And
he's a wonderful... I interviewed him once. Spent the day with him and his wife. Yeah. And
I was at their wedding. I danced at their wedding.
She's cool. They're so great. And I remember it was that show. Anyway, I'm sort of sidetracking, but he had that show about, like, before his big resurgence, he had me watch it in his screening room with him sitting this close to me watching my reactions. It was the most, like, nerve-wracking experience of my life.
It was like a prank show, right?
I don't remember anything except that he was sitting 5 feet from me, but I do think, yes, it was a prank show.
Yeah, I can't remember. He had a cute name. It was great.
Okay, so Howie, Jim, everybody's...
Yeah, they're all at the house. We'll say Jim was there, even though he wasn't, but yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, a super fabulous intervention.
Michael Rodenberg.
Oh, yeah. So I think it's important to have an A-level,
yes.
A-list intervention.
When you have an A-list intervention, you don't have to go over the precipice and flatline three times before you get sober. And I had only the best at my intervention and threw them out. But they were dear... Now, the truth is, they were dear friends. Were concerned about their pal who'd just gone too far.
And did you then embrace the sober community right away? Did you start making friends there?
I did, and yet I wouldn't get in the middle of the sober community. I will always... And this is the other thing. Is that I just hung out on the sidelines with my back against the wall and watched everybody else, just like in that dream thing we're talking about. I really didn't, after I had that moment of clarity on January 20th, 1989, I got in the middle a little more of the sober community and I started getting active. And that included sweeping up cigarette butts at the gathering places where the sober community, who may or may not be an institution with two initials in it, doing things like that, getting humble, just helping the sober community thing carry on. These are the things that everybody has to do. And certainly it was something that I needed to do. And it made me right size.
And what about those people?
Although today I'm plus size. But
what
that's
about
another
those
program.
People who don't think you need to do that, who seem to be just fine.
That's their journey. I don't judge anybody's recovery. If it's working for you, if you're not putting a substance in your body one day at a time, you're not being a complete asshole, God bless you. If you don't need to do that, there's many ways to sobriety. I don't think it has a lock on it. And even they say they have no monopoly on spirituality. So whatever works.
So here's what I find
the only one I don't believe in is the one, what was it called? MM.
Methods
of moderation.
Well,
yeah, I don't
moderation management.
Moderation management. I don't believe that works. When your founder ends up...
Well, yeah, but she ended up killing herself later.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, gosh.
But yeah, I mean, sadly, she had to be the one to prove it didn't work.
Yeah, here I was about to make this, you know, cavalier remark about her. I'm sorry to hear that she...
No. It was really... It's a sad story. I was actually once on Dr. Drew's show with her years before.
She haunted?
Yeah. No, she was destroyed by it. But yeah, I mean, there are treatment centers that I had somebody on my podcast who runs a treatment center. It hasn't aired yet, that teaches moderation. There's
really?
Only one that
really?
I know of, but he's got it.
Well, let's see how that works.
Well, now here's my question for you. What I found interesting about what you said was this idea that the alcoholism did not kick in until after your father's death. And yet you always had alcoholic thinking. So what do you think was going on those 24 years.
Well, I think if alcoholism is a stew, I think I was at a low, low simmer. And then after my dad was killed, I started throwing other substances into the mix, some of which accelerated my metabolism, let's say. And I think that those substances might have turned up the heat under the stew, or even been like a microwave oven. You know how like a pot roast can take like 6-7 hours in the stove, but
10 minutes
in a microwave. I think that's what happened when I started adding other substances to my alcohol consumption. It just, boom. And I was already just fried. All the part of the brain where it may be that makes you not able to, the enzymes that deplete that makes you not able to take one drink without experiencing the phenomenon of craving. So that just got superheated and I crossed the line much faster than I would have. Who knows? Maybe I'd only now be needing to get sober and I'd be, you know, like a street wino or something like that. I'd much rather it happened the way it did.
Yeah.
I got to have my 30s and my 40s and my 50s, you know, living a spiritual life and getting to help people.
I had a very similar, much like our co-occurring television shows of our childhood.
The Anna David Show?
The Anna David Show.
And she's walking up the driveway and the credits are rolling?
Yes.
I love that.
In a sort of one day at a time fashion, which I don't remember one day at a time.
I couldn't watch one day at a time because my parents divorced and my father moved to Europe for a time. So I was, you know, raised by a single mother.
Is that what it was about? I don't even remember.
It was about
Mackenzie Phillips.
Yeah.
Mackenzie Phillips and
Valerie Bertinelli. And they were raised by their single mom, that lovely red-haired lady whose name I can't remember. That was, switched the genders around. And there we were, my brother Paul and I being raised by mom, by Norma, and struggling through and having no money and all of it. So I live this, I don't need to watch. Let me watch Kojak instead. And he solves crimes.
But my point was that I too had the same thing of just, if it hadn't been for one particular other, I say my substance, if it hadn't been for coke, I think I would have been like a practicing alcoholic until I killed someone in a drunk driving accident, probably.
You say coke, I say Pepsi.
So what do you do today when difficult situations come up? The situations, the feelings that you had to numb?
Well, one of the things not to over-intellectualize it, but I've sort of learned that uncomfortable feelings are part of life. I think I had a fantasy that there are these people out there who never have a problem, who never have an uncomfortable feeling, who never have a loss, whether it's a person or a job or a romantic relationship, and that their lives are running perfectly and I'm the only one that has to experience these feelings. Everybody has to. What I've learned to do is sit still and know that the feeling is going to pass over me. Now, that said, there's one addiction left that my wife is on me about it, and I'm getting ready to get ready. Audience can't see me, but I'm a portly man. I'm a man who eats.
So do you think it is an addiction?
I think that there are certain foods that absolutely have an addictive...
Flour and sugar.
Flour and sugar. Those two things. When I stay away from flour and sugar, it almost melts off of me, and I don't experience cravings. But if I allow myself, I allow some sugar in, like I did this weekend. I went to a little crepe place in the valley with our mutual friend, Sarah.
She talks about you so fondly.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. She's great. She's like a dear pal. I do believe that man-woman palships are possible.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And she's a dear pal, but we went to this crepe place, and I decided, it had been a couple of weeks since I'd had some sugar, and that she'd had the chocolate crepe, and I tried one taste, and I thought, okay, all right, one last time, the denial that it's not the substance, it's my attitude towards it. I'll have this, and then it'll be fine. And I've been on a sugar run since Saturday, and today I haven't had any.
What does a sugar run look like?
A sugar run for me, if it's a disease, I'm in the disease of sugar while being sober from alcohol and drugs. For me, it's making little stops. It's before I get home, taking a trip I wouldn't take
to get 6 donuts? Like, what does that mean?
I would get, I'm a candy bar person.
Yeah.
And I'm especially a rare candy bar person. So I'll go to the British shops and get
Cadbury
or Crunchies, which is a Cadbury, or Violet Crumble, which is a better version of the Crunchy Bar. Or, you know, down to Monsieur Marcel at the farmer's market and hit them up for some of their imported chocolates. And I'll sometimes raid my kid's stash. You know, my kid's skinny as a rail, but he's got that metabolism. But there's a box of Pop-Tarts that he doesn't know that I know where he keeps his Pop-Tarts, in the garage. So, because that's where he jams, you know, that's where he and his band all you know, there's stuff. So,
but it's bad for him. So you're really just doing him.
Yeah,
a favor.
Of course I am. But I mean, I was going to sit and watch Timeless because my other obsession is time travel. Any show with time travel, I'm into it.
Interesting. So Timeless is a television show.
Oh yeah,
right,
yeah.
Now.
It's seen it. It's new on NBC.
Yes.
I don't do the promos for it though. Maybe, I don't know. Dorian Harwood does a fantastic job, so we'll leave that to him. Dorian Harwood. Sorry about that. Sorry, Dorian. I know your name. Anyway,
active listener. I'll have you know.
Yes?
I don't know.
I just that all us voiceover people know each other.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting to sit here and do a podcast and not tell you how I came up with the voice of the brain. It's actually really a relief.
Okay, but let's
no,
just...
No, I don't no, want...
because we'll delve... It didn't... We got so into...
I had a water, by the way.
Oh, did I move? Did I steal it?
Is that my water?
Yes, if it was Arrowhead.
Yeah.
I mean, Crystal Geyser. Yes. That was a trick.
Ah, very good. I just don't want to get too gravelly for your... For your listeners, I don't want to be the Mr.
Do I have to pay extra?
Voice man.
So talk to my listeners just briefly about your voiceover career and what that's...
I think I started to go down this road. You know, we talked about the anonymous programs and then me pulling back from the precipice, both of addiction and in comedy. I love the anonymity of voiceovers now.
But your voice is very distinct. Well, as we talked about, there have been things I've heard you on and I did not realize they were you.
You didn't know it was me.
Yeah.
Which is what I love. I've been on, I think the last count, 150 cartoon shows. And I never played the same character twice. On Futurama, I have played, somebody had a lot more time in his hands than I do, and counted up how many voices each of the eight actors on the show do. Katie Sagal does one, Leela, and she's brilliant at it. But I did 72 characters.
On
72
on
distinct characters, one-offs, recurrings, semi-regulars, and regulars.
On that one show.
72.
So when you, and then when you count 150 shows,
that's just one show. On Real Ghostbusters, I was Egon.
Dr. Egon Spengler, I collect spores, mold, and fungus.
And I was also like a ton of ghosts and creatures and things like that. Street vendors, that type of thing. On The Critic with John Lovitz, I played his Australian best friend, Jeremy Hawke.
And I also played Shackelford the Butler.
But I was also Orson Welles. Every time Orson Welles did a frozen peas commercial, and which is the same voice I use for the brain with just a little hint of Vincent Price thrown in. It's just, I get to play around and nobody knows it's me, which is great because there's no overexposure. It's like winning the lottery, but you get the 26 annual payments instead of the lump sum because I get to keep working and nobody knows it's me. And so I have like this great 35-year run of never having no work. I'd much rather have that.
And it's a career
I need to be busy
forever.
Yes.
As opposed to, say, TV writing.
Well, I hope for all my TV writer friends that proves not to be true.
No, but there's no ageism or anything else.
There doesn't seem to be, no. Certainly in voiceover, no, you can work. Michael Bell is still working. Michael Bell is the guy who came up with Butter.
Wow.
Parquet. Michael is still working. And they still pay him for that every time they pull that campaign out of mothballs. But Michael still does some Transformers stuff, and he's going up into his 80s. There are lots of... Frank Welker is 70, and Frank Welker has the longest listing on the IMDb of any actor, writer, director. You print out his thing in a regular 14-point Times Roman font. His listing will run, I think, up to around about 90 pages. He's been working since 1969. He was the original Freddy on Scooby-Doo, and he's still Freddy on Scooby-Doo. Because the man never smoked, never drank, never did anything to damage these membranes, these magic membranes of his.
Uh-oh, are yours? Well, you only did it heavily for 3 years.
I did it heavily for 3 years, but I'll tell you, I've lost a lot of my high end. So, but luckily,
from drinking
and smoking, I was a cigar addict for 20 years.
When did you stop that?
I stopped that 9 years ago. I smoked cigars even before I developed a drinking problem. It's just one of those things that it fixed me.
I find them so grotesque.
Aren't they awful?
I was around someone smoking one earlier today.
Oh my God.
Plugging my nose.
Well, I was that guy. I mean, I think you might remember even like maybe wanting to pull away from a hug because I was
no,
so...
No, I didn't know.
Really?
You. When you said cigar smoker, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
it
just cost like 4 or 5 a day. So
yeah.
To some degree, I've lost my high end, but I've gotten a little bit more of a bottom. I just don't want the throat cancer that might come with it. God forbid. I get to have that gravelly voice sometimes when that comes in handy. In a world where one man gives up cigars.
Did you like that movie, In a World?
I did. I found it as a peek behind the curtain, inside baseball movie. it played around with the reality of it. For instance, we are probably the least egotistical of the performer types, and we don't have the competition that's portrayed in that movie where they're like, we wish each other well. I mean, we're almost boring with how nice. We all know there's enough work to go around, and if I don't get it, I hope you get it, and I'll get the next one. But they're very healthy people in the voiceover business. Yeah, so I think because you take the face out of the equation, so there's much less involved. You get very tied up in our faces. That's where our self-esteem is. That's where our egos are. And so our identities are in our faces. So take away our so-called identities. We have to prove it to you in other ways with our voices and hopefully with some talent. I mean, making people laugh without the benefit of your face is a tough thing. Luckily, and that's why Mel Blanc was so brilliant, by the way. I mean, yes, he had great animators over at Warner Brothers doing the Bugs Bunny cartoons. But before he did that, he was on the Jack Benny radio show playing opposite the man known to have the best timing ever in the history of show business, Jack Benny. And so he learned by playing, thing of what, if you play tennis with somebody better than you, your game comes up. He became a master of comic timing with just his voice. Radio was a great proving ground for that type of entertainment, i.e. voiceovers, that type of thing.
Well, okay, so Maurice, we have to work towards wrapping up. Is there any final message that you have? I was kind of trying, I was thinking, ooh, can I kind of work this idea around you? You lose your ego because you lose your face to some idea about recovery. But then that was beyond my brain's comprehension.
Well, you just did it. I think so. I think that letting go of self to the degree that it's possible, because if you totally let go of self, become a pure altruist. I mean, I was just listening to a report on NPR? Or maybe I read it. I can't remember. It was just this week too, but I'm old, so this happens. It was about the difference in the type of brains that altruists have and psychopaths have. And it all had tied to the amygdala. And in a psychopath, the amygdala is very underdeveloped. And in altruists, and by definition, an altruist is someone who is willing to give up one kidney to a total stranger. That's the acid test they use.
I'm more towards a psychopath.
Overdeveloped, tremendous empathy. But most of us fall somewhere in between those two extremes.
I'm closer to the psychopath.
All right. I have to say that I'm very attached to my body parts, but I will get up in the middle of the night and go sit with somebody if they tell me they're about to take a drink or be on the phone for an hour or whatever it takes. And you don't even necessarily need to be taking a drink. I think we're supposed to help others. The books that those friends of mine who are in that AA thing that I'm not necessarily in, it says helping others, not other alcoholics. It's not exclusive to that. So some degree of learned altruism brings relief from the condition of self-obsession. And ego almost has to diminish as a result of that, especially if you don't take the credit for it and you go, well, something better than me is operating there, which I think there is. I do believe that there's definitely at least inspiration, nothing else. With this, all this great literature that we have, spiritual literature, where did it come from? Maybe that's the way God moves in our world, giving a bit of inspiration to people to write something that says, be better than you are, help others. Reach inside yourself. Don't hurt anybody, at the very least.
You can't help, don't hurt.
Yeah.
That's such a good note. So that was Maurice LaMarche on After Party Pod. If you like this podcast, why not go review it, right? It's easy. Just go to iTunes. Just slap a rating on there. That's good enough. If you want to find out more about Maurice LaMarche, he is on Twitter at Maurice LaMarche. I was going to say .com. You don't need the .com. It's not even a part of it. Anyway, I'll see you next time.